This is Healthline, a joint venture of WTIC News Talk 1080 and Yale Cancer Center. Yale Cancer Center is a resource for cancer programs throughout Connecticut, developing new advances in prevention, screening, diagnosis, and treatment. On Healthline, you'll hear from some of the leading doctors in the country. Healthline is not intended to provide medical advice. Yale Cancer Center urges you to consult with a qualified physician in your community for diagnosis and for answers to your medical questions. And now, our co-hosts, oncologists Ken Miller and Ed Chu.
Good morning and welcome to Healthline. My name is Dr. Ed Chu, and I'm Chief of Medical Oncology here at the Yale Cancer Center in New Haven. My co-host, Dr. Ken Miller, is still away on a well-deserved vacation with his family in Barcelona, Spain. And so I'll be doing it solo today with our special guest. Healthline with the Yale Cancer Center is our way of providing you with the most up-to-date information on cancer care every Sunday morning at 8:30 a.m. here on this station, WTIC News Talk 1080. Our Healthline program features some of the nation's leading oncologists and cancer specialists who are on the forefront of the battle to fight cancer right here in our state of Connecticut. Each week, we're joined by a different expert from the Yale Cancer Center, and together we discuss the myths about cancer, the latest treatments available to cancer patients, and advances in clinical research. Our goal is to give you help and hope. We will answer your questions and provide you with the latest information on cancer. If you would like to submit a question about cancer to Healthline, please email us at healthline@yale.edu or call 1-888-234-4YCC, and we will try to answer your questions on air in a future broadcast. If you're interested in listening to past editions of Healthline, or if you would like to learn more about a specific kind of cancer, all of our shows are now posted in both audio and written formats on the Yale Cancer Center website at www.yalecancercenter.org. Today, our program focuses on the treatment advances in brain cancer, and our special guest today is Dr. Joaquin Baring, an assistant professor of neurology and medicine and medical oncology at the Yale Cancer Center. Joaquin, thanks so much for being with us today on Healthline.
Thank you, Ed. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start with a quick overview. What is brain cancer? As I understand it, there are many different types.
Yeah, there are two major groups. There are primary brain tumors and secondary or metastatic brain tumors. The latter group are tumors that arise or that seed from different sites in the body, like the breast or the lung. The former group, the primary brain tumors, will be the focus of our show today, and these are cancers that arise from cells that are resident to the brain, such as the nerve cells themselves or supporting cells called glial cells.
And I gather in adults and children also the type of primary brain tumor is a little bit different.
That is correct, yeah. The spectrum of diseases is age-dependent. In the adult patient population, the most common tumors are those that arise from these supporting cells called gliomas, and the most best known one of those is glioblastoma multiforme. Whereas in children, tumors that are called embryonal tumors, such as medulloblastoma, are more common, or neuroblastoma.
And perhaps you can give our listeners some idea of, you know, how many patients are diagnosed each year in the United States with this primary form of brain tumor called glioblastoma?
Overall, fortunately, brain tumors compared to other types of cancer are still rare. There are only about 18,000 to 20,000 cases of newly diagnosed primary brain cancers in the United States. In terms of glioblastoma, unfortunately, the largest single group of brain tumors within those 20,000 cases is the most malignant form, glioblastoma multiforme. So I would estimate that you'll see about 7,000 cases of that a year in the U.S.
And at what age does this kind of cancer typically present?
As for most forms of cancer, the risk of developing brain cancer is age-dependent. So the age group that is most affected are patients older than 50 to 60 years of age. But there are exceptions, and there's a substantial number of younger patients who can be affected.
And any difference between men and women in terms of who actually can get this type of cancer?
For most subtypes, and that is true also for glioblastoma, the gender distribution is fairly even. For some, there's a slight male preponderance.
Okay, and what are some of the main risk factors for developing brain cancer?
That is still unknown. The only firmly established risk factor for primary brain cancer is exposure to high doses of radiation. Patients who had to have radiation for some form of brain tumors in their childhood are at a higher risk of developing a second type of brain cancer later in life. Very few cases, and that is in the order of less than 1% of all patients diagnosed with brain cancer, have a genetic predisposition of developing such. It's likely that there are other environmental factors, but research has been hampered by the fact that these tumors are rare and connections are difficult to establish.
Any truth to the, maybe this is a myth, that there's an association between exposure to the power lines that we see, you know, in the neighborhoods and the development of brain cancer?
Yeah, that has been frequently suspected whenever there's a cluster of brain cancer arising. Obviously, an environmental cause is sought, and power lines have been suspected in the past, but I'm not aware of any study that formally proved that exposure to electromagnetic waves played a role in one of those clusters of brain cancer.
And how about the exposure to cell phones?
That's probably hottest topic. There are several studies, and naturally all of them are actually retrospective, that found no correlation between cell phone use and the development of brain cancer. However, more recently a study was published that did seem to suggest that there may be a correlation. I'm not sure. The risk seems to be rather low, otherwise we probably would know by now from these large-scale studies. However, as we learned with many other environmental exposures, it may take 20, 30 years of exposure to statistically actually see an increase in the incidence. So I think that is still an issue that requires research.
And just getting back to the potential genetic risk factors. So you did mention that there may be some genetic linkage, is that right?
That is correct. There are a few syndromes. Most of these syndromes are involved with the repair of errors that occur during the process of DNA replication. The DNA is that molecule that contains the genetic information of the cell, and it's quite a task for the cell to duplicate this molecule prior to cell division. And there are intricate mechanisms that monitor the accuracy of this process, and many of these syndromes actually affect the repair process of mistakes that occur during the process.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe we can get into a little bit about some of the symptoms that individuals might present with a brain tumor.
The most common symptoms of brain cancer are actually headache and a seizure. Now, obviously, not everybody who has a headache has to be worried about that they might come down with brain cancer. Headache is the most common complaint that patients come to the emergency room with. However, a headache that gets more intense week after week, month after month, a headache that's fairly localized, that should get a patient's attention. They should seek advice by their family doctor, and many times an imaging study then can be performed that either diagnoses a brain tumor or rules it out. Seizures are obviously more dramatic. Mm-hmm. Now, not every patient who has a seizure turns out to have a brain tumor. There are many causes of seizure disorders, and many times no specific cause is found. Seizure would certainly warrant a workup for the possibility of a brain tumor.
And the other symptoms that one needs to be aware of?
Well, sometimes symptoms are much less dramatic and insidious. Sometimes patients come who complain of memory loss, or they are brought in by family members who are afraid that their loved one comes down with Alzheimer's disease. So sometimes it takes on the picture degenerative disorders like dementia.
Mm-hmm. And so how does one go about making the diagnosis of brain cancer?
Once it's clinically suspected, the most sensitive test that is non-invasive is actually magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI. And having that technique at hand has made diagnosis of a brain tumor fairly straightforward.
Now, if someone is claustrophobic, which I have to say yours truly is, are there alternatives to MRI?
Well, there are technical advances in the MRI technique, and now there are actually machines available with large bores where patients do not feel claustrophobic. You call those open MRIs. There are even now MRIs available where patients can sit or even stand or watch TV. Also, scans can be done under sedation, so that is usually not a problem.
Okay. Great. Well, we'd like to remind you to email your questions to healthline@yale.edu or call 1-888-234-4YCC. At this time, we're going to take a short break for Medical Minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about the treatment of brain tumors with our special guest, Dr. Behring.
This is a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by the Yale Cancer Center. Cancer patients become cancer survivors the first day they're diagnosed. There are over 10 million cancer survivors in the U.S., and the numbers keep growing. However, there are long-term side effects of cancer, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, impaired growth, and an increased risk of second cancers. Ending cancer treatment can be both exciting and scary. Most people are relieved to be finished with the demands of treatment, but many also feel concerned about whether the cancer will come back and what they can do to prevent a relapse. Cancer survivors require long-term specialized care and support. For more information, log on to www.yalecancercenter.org. That address once again, www.yalecancercenter.org.
Welcome back to Healthline. This is Dr. Ed Chu, and I'm in the WTIC studios with our guest, Dr. Joaquin Behring, an expert in brain cancer at the Yale Cancer Center. Joaquin, before the break, we were talking about how to diagnose patients with breast cancer, brain cancer using imaging techniques. So once an MRI has been done, which, as you say, is kind of the gold standard for visualizing a brain tumor, how does one go about making the actual diagnosis?
The actual diagnosis is dependent on a piece of tissue that one has to examine under the microscope. Rarely ever do we rely on the MRI alone. The first step in diagnosing a brain tumor is a surgical procedure, and that can either consist of a biopsy, where a small piece of tissue is retrieved from the tumor, or sometimes the diagnostic and the first therapeutic step are combined, and the tumor is actually resected as in part or as a whole, and a diagnosis is established with the first step of the treatment.
I guess that would depend on how what the size of the tumor looked on the MRI.
That is correct. It depends on the size of the tumor. It depends on the location of the tumor. If the tumor is in a very sensitive area of the brain, such as the strength control or the language control area, many times the surgical procedure has to be limited to a biopsy, since resection of the whole mass would lead to an irrecoverable neurological deficit. So location and size of the tumor, also the type of the suspected type of the tumor are important in making a decision.
So obviously difficult to generalize because there are many different kinds of brain cancer. But if we deal with the most common form, the glioblastoma multiforme, what are the usual treatment options that are available to patients?
The first step of treatment is surgery. That is well established. In most patients, an attempt will be made to remove at least a large portion of the tumor, if not everything that's visible on an MRI scan. That relieves symptoms. Sometimes symptoms are only caused by the mere mass effect of the tumor, and once the mass is and the pressure is relieved, patients reacquire normal function. Intractable headaches can be resolved after surgery. So there are seizures actually are much easier to control once the tumor has been removed many times. So for glioblastoma multiforme, surgical resection is the mainstay of initial therapy.
What's the role of radiation therapy?
Most brain tumors and first and foremost glioblastoma multiforme require a multidisciplinary approach, and the first what you call adjuvant treatments, meaning treatments that are provided after surgery that was proven to be of benefit to this patient population, was radiotherapy. The purpose of radiotherapy is actually to target the what you call the infiltrative edge of the tumor. These tumors are not sharply circumscribed, so even though the surgeon can take out what he can see on the MRI, there are still tumor cells left behind that are invisible on the scan, and that is the target of radiotherapy. The radiotherapy actually aims at more than what was seen on the initial MRI scan.
And is there any role for chemotherapy at all once the tumor has been removed by surgery?
For a large number of brain tumors, and again including glioblastoma multiforme, chemotherapy has been shown to further increase survival. The largest group of medications that one uses for brain cancer are so-called alkylating agents. They are given either concomitantly with the radiation or both during radiation and after radiation. They are usually also considered adjuvant therapies. There are few indications to use chemotherapy up front before a tumor resection is attempted.
Now, one of the things you mentioned just a little while ago is the multidisciplinary approach. And I guess one really important point to emphasize to our listeners is that if one has a brain tumor, it really is important to go to a center that, in fact, approaches patients in this multidisciplinary fashion. And maybe you can explain a little bit about what is available here at the Yale Cancer Center.
Yeah, that is correct. As I mentioned initially, brain tumors are rare tumors. That means unless you are in a center that specializes on treatment of these rare cancers, doctors don't have the same exposure as we have at Yale. Now, what multidisciplinary means is a combined effort between a number of departments, that is neurosurgery, neurology, medical oncology, neuropathology, therapeutic radiology, and diagnostic radiology. And in every single one of these fields, you will have an expert at Yale who is not only familiar with most of the new treatment approaches, but also has one foot in a laboratory, probably, and is up to date in research or basic science research in brain tumors, and is involved in the process of getting these new insights translated into new treatment strategies.
Now, as part of the Yale Cancer Center, we have the Yale Brain Tumor Center. How can a patient access help and information from your brain center?
There are a couple of options. We have a website for the Yale Cancer Center. There's a subsite for the Brain Tumor Center. You can also directly get to that at the address yalebraintumorcenter.org. There's also a phone number. We have a clinical coordinator who receives phone calls and then triages patients to whatever subspecialist within the center they should be initially referred to. Her name is Betsy DeAndrea, and her number is 203-737-1671.
Great. I think that's really very, very helpful information to our listeners out there. One thing that's been discussed quite a bit these days is the use of Gamma Knife. I was wondering if you could explain to our listeners what that's all about.
Yeah, gamma knife radiosurgery is a very interesting new development in radiotherapy of tumors within the brain. The advantage of gamma knife radiosurgery is that in a single session, a large dose of radiation can be given to a very small defined area within the brain. As opposed to standard radiotherapy, where not only the tumor is exposed, but also a large portion of normal brain, and there are long-term side effects from exposure of normal brain to radiation. You don't have to worry as much with focused radiotherapy, gamma knife radiotherapy. However, I have to say that the application is limited to certain types of tumors. It's a very interesting tool for metastatic tumors, but for glioblastoma, it is certainly not the first treatment of choice.
Okay. Great. Well, we'd like to remind you to email your questions to healthline@yale.edu or call 1-888-234-4YCC. At this point, we're going to take a short break to listen to a survivor story. Please stay tuned to learn more information about the new treatment strategies for brain cancers with our special guest, Dr. Joachim Behring.
A few years ago, the diagnosis of cancer was a death sentence for many patients. But today, thanks to advances in clinical research, we're turning the corner in the battle against cancer. There are over 10 million cancer survivors now living in the U.S. They are the true heroes in the war against cancer. Here's a story of a hero from Hamden.
10 years ago, when I was diagnosed with aplastic anemia, there was no cure. After teaching math for 35 years, I was forced to retire. Dr. Tom Duffy at the Yale Cancer Center told me about a new procedure called a mini stem cell transplant. He encouraged me to put my life in the hands of Dr. Stuart Seropian, one of the few doctors in the country doing this procedure. On January 17, 2004, I had a stem cell transplant at the Yale Cancer Center. At age 70, I feel like a new man. I owe a great debt of gratitude to my anonymous stem cell donor and to the terrific staff at the Yale Cancer Center. They literally saved my life.
This survivor's story has been brought to you by Yale Cancer Center.
Welcome back to Healthline. This is Dr. Ed Chu, and I'm in the WTIC studios with our guest, Dr. Joaquin Baring, an expert in the treatment of brain cancers here at the Yale Cancer Center. Joaquin, before the break, we were talking about the different treatment options that are available to patients with brain cancer. And you and Dr. Pietmeyer have been very actively involved in developing what's called convection-enhanced delivery chemotherapy. Could you explain to our listeners what that is?
Sure, I'd be happy to. There's maybe one thing I should explain beforehand. One of the problems with treating brain cancer is the fact that the brain is actually very well protected physiologically from environmental toxins. Mechanism is called the blood-brain barrier. That not only makes it hard for toxins to get into the brain, but also treatments, chemotherapy that are delivered into a vein. One approach to circumvent this physiological barrier, the blood-brain barrier, is to administer drugs directly into the brain. And convection-enhanced delivery is the most promising technique to achieve that goal. Practically, what it means is that at the time of tumor resection, microcatheters, and usually three or four, are placed around the resection cavity, the hole that's left behind by the surgeon. And then once the wound is closed, these microcatheters are attached to microinfusion pumps that deliver either conventional chemotherapy drugs or newly developed drugs directly into the brain. Usually these infusions are done in the intensive care unit and they last up to 4 days.
So the beauty of this approach is that you're directly administering the active chemotherapy agent, but hopefully, and so obviously it'll be attacking the residual brain tumor cells, but protecting the rest of the body from any type of side effects.
That's correct. Most of these treatments have minimal, if any, side effects in the whole system, and the concentration of drug that can be achieved within brain tissue is likely much higher than it is with a drug that's administered into a vein.
And you folks were involved with the clinical study here at the Yale Cancer Center?
Yeah, we were involved at various stages of a clinical study that used a genetically engineered protein for brain tumor therapy. This protein contained a bacterial toxin, which was the actual mechanism by which tumor cells are intended to kill by this molecule, that was delivered through convection-enhanced delivery. And we were involved in the very early stages of this technique, and then also participated in what you call a phase 3 clinical study, which is a study where the new treatment approach is compared to standard of care.
And was there much in the way of systemic side effects seen with this therapy?
We actually did not see any systemic side effects. Very few patients had a seizure or a temporary worsening of a neurological symptom. However, that is something that occurs spontaneously in patients after brain surgery. So we have to wait for the final report after the data are processed. That is not out yet.
Now, as you say, because of this blood-brain barrier, it's been very difficult for the traditional chemotherapy drugs to get into the brain and to be able to attack the brain cancer cells. What are some of the newer treatment strategies that are being taken to fight brain cancer?
There are numerous of new treatment strategies. There are drugs being developed that cross this blood-brain barrier more easily. Probably the field of greatest interest in cancer in general and brain cancer in particular are molecules designed to target certain growth-promoting pathways within brain cancer cells. And And you refer to this group as medications, small molecule inhibitors. And as the name says, the molecular weight is quite small, and these drugs penetrate into the brain much easier than some of the traditional compounds.
Now, I know our own group in medical oncology is trying to develop a number of these novel small molecules that either target the growth factor signaling pathways or a process that's known as angiogenesis, which is a process that inhibits the growth of new blood vessels. And I'm wondering if this might be a really good opportunity for patients with brain cancer to be tested with some of these newer agents.
Yeah, there are a number of very interesting studies going on for systemic cancer at the Yale Cancer Center, and we are in the process of establishing protocols in which brain cancer patients can be included. Some of these protocols do not include brain cancer patients for various reasons, and that will be the next step. But there are certainly a lot of things going on that we are very much interested in particular the angiogenesis inhibitors. These are drugs that prevent or interfere with the growth of blood vessels in tumors, and tumors are dependent on this blood vessel growth because they need oxygen, otherwise they can't grow. And there are some very encouraging data out there for the use of some of these angiogenesis inhibitors combined with other drugs in brain cancer, and we are exploring those.
Are there any trials that you'd like to highlight that are presently ongoing or being offered to patients here at the Yale Cancer Center?
We've just finished accrual for a number of clinical studies. The studies that will open very shortly is a study of a chemotherapy compound that is considered standard of care at this point for glioblastoma multiforme. However, we will use a higher dose than what would be considered standard of care. This is a very well-tolerated treatment, so it only makes sense to try to increase the dose, push it more to what is tolerated, and see if it's more effective than the standard dose is. We have a trial that is going through the internal approval process for patients with a tumor called primary central nervous system lymphoma, and we're working on opening a study using one of these angiogenesis inhibitors for glioblastoma multiforme.
If a patient or a patient's family member is interested in accessing information regarding the types of clinical trials that are available to them here at the Yale Cancer Center, how do they go about doing that?
I mentioned our website before, the Yale Cancer Center website. That is probably the most up-to-date and most easily accessible resource. There's a section for clinical trials for the Brain Tumor Center that can be accessed, where patients or physicians can immediately see what clinical studies are currently open. However, sometimes studies, there's obviously a certain lag between updates on this website. So to be sure, it's probably best to call our clinical coordinator, Betsy DeAndrea.
And again, that number is?
It's 203-767-1671.
Okay. 767 or 737?
737, I'm sorry.
Okay, if you have questions for Dr. Behring or for Healthline, we encourage you to go to our website, yalecancercenter.org, for more information about cancer and the resources available to you. Before we sign off, Joaquin, in your opinion, what are some of the key messages you'd like to share with our listeners about the treatment of brain cancers?
I think the key message is that we can look much more optimistically on the treatment of brain cancer these days. I think there are a lot of very interesting new treatment approaches in the pipeline that will hopefully become available for a broader range of patients that will make a big difference in the outcome of these devastating tumors. Other than that, I think it's important to point out that since these tumors are so rare, patients are likely best treated in large referral centers where a multidisciplinary team of experts works together.
Great. Well, terrific. So Joaquin, I'd like to thank you for joining us today on Healthline. And remember, tune into WTIC News Talk 1080 every Sunday morning at 8:30 a.m. for Healthline with the Yale Cancer Center. Our next program will feature Commissioner J. Robert Galvin from the Connecticut Department of Public Health. Until then, this is Dr. Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center wishing you a safe and healthy week.
You've been listening to Healthline, a joint venture of Yale Cancer Center and WTIC News Talk 1080. Join us next Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 a.m. for another edition of Healthline on WTIC News Talk 1080.